Let's call the meeting of the Senate Special Committee on Trans-Alaska Pipeline System Throughput Order. Let the record reflect that it is 13:30 on Thursday, January 22nd, 2013. We're in the Belts Room 105 in the Tom Stewart Building. And I'll let the record show that we have a quorum to do business. Present are Chairman Michicki, Co-Chair Dunleavy, Senator McGuire, Senator Faircloth, and Senator Gardner. Also like to note the presence of Senator Geisel. She was here. And I don't see any other elected officials in the room. And this might be a little bit unusual, but I would like to also take the opportunity to wish Senator Liesl McGuire a very happy birthday. I'd like to recognize our committee staff, Nancy Jones from Senate Records, and LIO staff, Emily Waste. And I'd like to remind everyone to please turn off your cell phones. The purpose of our meeting today, and again, remember, put on your glasses, committee members, if you will. Those glasses show that we're looking through challenges to decreasing the decline of production from North Slope. And so anything that we're looking at here, this is not an oil tax committee. It's a committee designed to arrest throughput decline. With that, the purpose of the meeting today is to begin discussion on Senate Bill 21, which is the governor's bill on oil and gas production taxes. And beginning the presentation of the bill will be Commissioner Dan Sullivan, Department of Natural Resources, Commissioner Brian Butcher from Department of Revenue, and they'll be followed by Joe Balash and Mike Pulowski. So, gentlemen, commissioners, please feel free to join us. Identify yourself. Today's meeting is testimony is by invitation only. And you are two first invitees. Congratulations.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Sullivan, the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. So, Mr. Chairman, just going to ask a quick question here. Do you want us to go through this electronically? Is anyone watching this? I'm trying to
sense if... I will ask a question of the technical staff. Apparently, our screen is not working. We have the overhead behind us, and we have handouts before us. So I would say just
glad to do it.
Proceed, and we'll see how it works out technically.
Great. Well, good to be here. We first want to just thank the committee for the opportunity to testify. We actually also want to thank the Senate for the public service that you've done in establishing this special committee and its goal, as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, at the outset. The issue of TAP's throughput decline, we believe, is the most urgent one facing the economic future of our state. And the more Alaskans who understand this challenge, but also understand the solution sets, because we think there are many, the more likely we will be able to address this together for the benefit of all Alaskans. I'm going to begin, but I also want to just reference Commissioner Butcher. One of the things that we've been doing over the last several months is having a very integrated DNR, Department of Revenue team working this issue, and we think that's positive for the state. That's something the governor wanted us to do, and I think you'll see both with our testimony and in some ways even more impressively Deputy Commissioner Balash and Mike Pulowski's testimony how that work is coming together. So wanted you to be aware of that. So at least the goals of the presentation today and what we will do, Mr. Chairman, is go through this PowerPoint, if that's okay. The slides are numbered on the bottom right-hand corner. Sometimes they're hard to...
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yeah, sometimes they're hard to see. but in the bottom right-hand corner have different slide numbers. But we wanted to first, particularly given that it's Commissioner Butcher and mine's first opportunity to testify here, provide a little background on TAPS, which I think most of you will be certainly up to speed on, describe what we see some of the challenges, and then also we think importantly, particularly for the first hearing, is to put the challenges in the broader context of what's happening not only in Alaska but in the U.S. and even in the world in terms of hydrocarbon production, hydrocarbon investment, and then most importantly we want to demonstrate with examples that to underscore the issue that decline in Alaska is not inevitable, that the past does not have to be the prologue. Provide some examples of this point because we think that that's a really important issue. So I'll begin, and then Commissioner Butcher is going to move into more of some of the tax and kind of broader finance-related issues for this presentation.
Commissioners, question for you. Would you prefer waiting until the end of the presentation, or do you like folks to jump right in during the presentation?
Whatever your preference is.
Yeah, we're fine having it be interactive.
Either way, more of a conversation if you'd like
that. Okay, that sounds good.
As long as the questions aren't too hard.
Okay, if you have easy questions, committee, feel free at any point. Thank you, sir. Okay.
So just to begin, if you look at slide number 2, and that this is, again, just a little bit of background probably for everybody in the room. It's a bit of a review, but just the critical nature of TAPS, not only for the state, but also for the country. And slide 2 does remind us that the U.S. Congress was instrumental in the approval and rapid development of TAPS. So there was all kinds of aspects of the federal law in terms of the development, building, limitations of lawsuits for TAPS that was critical. And we think reminding Alaskans of that congressional role is important because we do think that the throughput issue certainly has federal elements to it, and the Congress can play a very important aspect to that as well, not only for the benefit of Alaskans but for the energy security of the country. Federal access to access federal lands, we think, is one important area in that regard. So if you look at slide three. Again, it goes into a little bit more detail on the background history of TAPS. I think most of this is well known, but it is always important to, I think, take a look at these numbers. At one point, TAPS was 25% of U.S. domestic production when we were actually producing a lot more oil. And the numbers, if you look at those, 2.2 million barrels a day at its peak, those are in some ways astounding numbers. I've had the opportunity to be in a number of different oil provinces, and I'm sure there might be, but even in Saudi Arabia, Russia, Central Asia, there are not many pipes that are 2.2 million barrels a day. It's just an impressive, in some ways staggering number. But we certainly see the throughput decline as threatening our economic future. And obviously, at this juncture, when we're at a little under 600,000 barrels a day, there's a lot of excess capacity. And historically, we're not at that capacity anymore. There was a reconfiguration of TAPS. Its capacity now with less pump stations is about 1.2 million barrels a day, kind of on average. And then it's also, we think, important to make the case there's a lot of talk about giveaways, right? We think the ultimate giveaway is the year after year decline that we're seeing in the throughput. Because just for example, Bloomberg reported last year, December 2011, 622,000 barrels. December 2012, 582,000 barrels a day. So that's 40,000 barrels in a year that are gone. So if you do the math on average, 40,000 barrels a day over the course of a year, that's a number of about 4.7 million barrels. at $100 a barrel, that's $1.5 billion is gone. It's not circulating in the economy. It's not circulating in state coffers. It's gone. And that, from our perspective, is the giveaway that we're trying to arrest and turn around. And I think people need to keep that in mind. Inaction means the giveaway is going to continue each year. So the next slide, if you look, I know many have seen this. This is the slide of just the ANS production. And I think the takeaway here is that in Alaska, we certainly have mature fields, Prudhoe being the obvious one, the blue that dominates that entire slide. This picture is really the picture of our challenge. But it's important to distinguish a mature field from a mature basin. And we think that we still have a basin, if you look at the North Slope writ large, if you look at state, federal, and in different opportunities, whether it's conventional, large fields like what Shell's looking for, whether it's shale plays, heavy, viscous, we still think from that perspective, we don't have a mature basin. We have some mature fields, but this point on opportunity we think is huge and very important, and I'll dig into a little bit more detail here. So the other issue, Mr. Chairman, that we just wanted to highlight is just the urgency. And we see that this is, as we've mentioned, urgent. In the past, when people said, hey, this is really urgent, well, that's a scare tactic. We don't think it's a scare tactic at all to highlight how important and urgent this issue is. And, you know, this slide, slide number five, reminds us, this was 2 years ago. It's kind of interesting because I know Admiral Barrett, Tom Barrett for Alyeska, I think this was his first week on the job, if you remember what happened with our taps shutting down and 40 below zero. It was my third week on the job, so, you know, I think both Admiral Barrett and I were both kind of like, oh my gosh, what did we sign up for here? But I think that it's really important, having been up there, having seen how close, we really dodged a bullet on that one. And I think, you know, the state workers, Alyeska workers, everybody involved who got that pipeline back and running, but it was not at all, and there's a Petroleum News article that we're citing, it was not at all clear that that was going to happen, that a cold restart was that easy to pull off. And I think a couple lessons from that is the lower the output that we're continuing to see, the more we have the run the risks of those kind of stoppages or shutdowns. Not for sure, but there's no doubt from a technological perspective, the less oil that's flowing through, the more challenges you have on some of the technical aspects. The companies are, you know, certainly spending on maintaining this, trying to address some of these problems, but we also have to recognize what the consequences of that are, which is a higher tariff, and it, which makes it in some ways harder for not only the companies, but companies that aren't the incumbents to actually get in and produce with higher tariffs. And that's obviously less revenue for the state. And so what's really some...
Mr. Commissioner, just a quick statement. I think it's important that you paraphrase it again. Is even for those that disagree that a lower flow rate will have operational issues, there's no one that denies that it increases the cost of moving oil per barrel down the pipeline. And it's very important for folks to understand that.
Correct. And I don't think there's much, I mean, Admiral Barrett, if he testifies, I don't think there's much dispute that lower flow rates create a higher risk of complications. I haven't heard many people push back on that.
I personally agree with you.
Mr. Dillon, a couple questions.
Senator.
Commissioner, are you convinced that we can flatten out or increase the decline?
Through the chair, absolutely. I mean, we're going to talk. These slides get to that point, and I think Senator Dunleavy, what we're going to show here is one of the biggest things is a couple things that we think are important. A, just the resource base that's still up there, and then B, examples of other basins doing that. And we think that having an example or two or three or four where that's happened is important for this committee to recognize that.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. And just a kind of follow-up to that idea is, do you think that as we work to decrease the decline, flatten that out, do you see the future as being largely with the majors or with new companies coming in, smaller companies?
So through the chair, Senator Gardner, I think that's it's a great question. And the way we have typically answered that, the way I certainly firmly believe it's with all players, right? So we need, so the idea that it's only the majors, I think, is misdirected, although obviously they're sitting on fields that are still huge. The idea that it's only new players like Great Bear that can save us, I think, is misdirected. What we've been trying to do, and I'll talk about it, is we've been going out and we have been promoting, pitching, encouraging investment from the entire diversity of companies, super majors to small guys, and the entire diversity of plays. Because that's the other thing that I think we have a really, really strong opportunity with regard to, you know, everybody's talking about North Dakota and the Eagleford in Texas. Those are good examples, but they're principally shale plays, right? North Dakota in particular. The opportunity we see is obviously Shell is looking for another Prudhoe, and whether or not we hope they find it, hope they're going to develop it responsibly, of course. But you have everything from that to shale plays. And one of the things that we have been certainly promoting throughout the country is we're probably one of the few, if only, basins that we know of where you can actually be exploring for a shale play and run into a, you know, 30 to 100 million barrel of oil conventional field. I don't think you have that opportunity in North Dakota. So that's a long answer to your question, but we think it's all comers, incumbents, new guys, huge new players, middle-sized companies, small players. But increasing competition on the North Slope is something we think is critically important.
Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure that the record is accurate in its reflection of the shutdown in 2011, we might look back and think that it was an easy restart, but there was a great trepidation. There was just a, you know, it might have been easy. It was just some of the words that were chosen. We didn't know if we'd get that licorice stick moving again, depending on how solid those petroleum projects became. And so I just wanted to know that we were fortunate that we had great employees on the pipeline side, as well as good attorneys, as I understand it, up on the North Slope with us to fight to restart that, just because of how language in TAPS is worded. If we shut down a pipeline, that we have to dismantle it. And so there can be questions from others outside of our jurisdictions that that may want to stop the flow of that pipe.
So, through the chair, Senator Faircloth, I think your depiction of it is accurate.
Thank you.
And it wasn't something that, I mean, I was up there when we were in Fairbanks when we were getting ready to do the restart. There was a lot of, as you know, kind of pushing back and forth with certain entities and the, you know, whether or not that was going to get going again when we finally got the green light. It was certainly not 100% clear at all.
Senator Dunleavy.
Commissioner, I'm sure you're going to get to this, but there's just a question or two I just need to ask. Do you believe that if we create the right environment, let's say we create the right environment, whatever that is, this year, what would be the timeline for that you believe that we can begin the process of stemming decline? That obviously would have to come off of existing fields using whatever technology, but what type of scenarios or timelines are you looking at? Initially, it would be existing production or existing wells at Prudhoe, existing oil, and then if we have the right environment, climate, when do you see new oil coming online?
So through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I think it's a question that's a really important one for this committee. I think it'd be a little hard for us to kind of make that prediction, but you're right that the infield drilling would be an obvious place where the turnaround could start. But, you know, we've had some exploration already, and I have a slide here to show you that's been going on outside the big units. And I think that even some of those can turn into capable production, you know, within a few years, right? 3 or 4 years. I mean, just look at Point Thompson, right? Now, that's a settlement that, trust me, that has some real tight timelines, but it shows you that company Exxon right now is going to be the operator. They are starting to build it this winter, and their target that they have to meet pursuant to the settlement for the liquids portion is 3 years from this winter. So 3 years, and that's a multi-billion dollar project, and that will be by the winter 2015, 2016, they will be producing, according to the agreement, they will be producing liquids into taps. So that's an example of pretty quick project. And by the way, this is something I know the committee is familiar. We actually had a commitment from them that would have been a year earlier. And unfortunately, we had some delays on the federal permitting up there that we missed the winter season, and we had to push that back by a year.
Well, and take good notes. I think that's part of what the reason why we're formed is to see on the state side if there is legislation that we can help streamline that amount of time between discovery and production. So,
I think that's a huge issue.
Sure. Okay, proceed. So, if I can, I want to point out the fact that Senator Bishop has joined the group as well. Thank you, Senator.
So the final point on this episode two winters ago was we certainly feel, and again, if you ask Admiral Barrett, I think the best way to address these issues, and even the technical issues, is to get more oil through taps. And so that's another reason why that should be an urgent goal. So if you look to slide six, I think what we tried to do was initially set up in a broad way the challenge and what we see as the challenge, why we think it's urgent. But we also believe, and I know the committee is focused on this, that there's a number of positive aspects to either what's happening in what we have in Alaska or what's happening globally that address the question of can we turn this around. And I think the first and foremost important question, and we would be glad to have the real experts in this area, our geologists and others, come to brief the committee, and they are real experts. But the number one thing we have going for us is the huge world-class resource basin that we still have on the North Slope. And so you look at these numbers, and these are estimates, right? We kind of talked about how the definitions work in a hearing yesterday. But technically, the technical recoverable undiscovered is a broad, we know that's a broad category, but that's conventional. Still, it's estimated, these are federal estimates, about 40 billion barrels. This is North Slope wide, so state, federal, OCS. And then gas, the number on conventional gas is over 200 trillion cubic feet, conventional. So these are huge numbers. But what's even more, in some ways, exciting from our perspective, and you're seeing it all across the country, certainly, is we are really just scratching the surface on what we think we have with regard to unconventional hydrocarbons. So shale oil, heavy oil, viscous oil, shale gas. And we think, and we're looking, and so is the federal government, the USGS, we think that those numbers are in the multiple billions. So again, just the heavy and viscous, right, within the units. So we think that that is somewhere else where the opportunity, in some ways, is just being unlocked with all the new technology in the last 10 years. We put the sub-bullet down there. It is just another one example, but you know, the potential on methane hydrates with regard to gas is literally off the charts, and there's been some positive well testing that took place over the last year. And then we always like to highlight the fact that another area why we think there's a lot of opportunity is that despite it being such an important basin to the country and the world, the North Slope is still very relatively unexplored relative to most other hydrocarbon basins in the U.S. So that's in part because of the cost of exploring up there, but it just, the combination of all these factors, we think, from a geological perspective, makes the opportunity from a geological perspective very significant. And in many ways, from the committee's perspective, I'm sure this is something you look at as with regard to as a threshold issue. If we don't think we have any resources up there, well, then we can't do much about the TAPS throughput. But if we do, and we think that the potential up there is decades more oil or gas or heavy oil or viscous oil or shale oil, and it can, you know, be a huge economic engine and source of revenue for another generation or two of Alaskans, then that's also important. And we're certainly on the more optimistic side with regard to that. One other thing I wanted to mention here is that one of the things that we've talked a lot about is we've gone out, we've tried to market the state, we've pitched all these numbers, we've pitched certain companies, we've gone to conferences, and that's in part to hear what the to try and bring more investors up, and we've had some success in that regard. But also what's useful about those is you get feedback. And one of the most common themes we hear from kind of company executives, big companies, middle companies, small companies, great hydrocarbon structure, one of the best in the world that most of these guys have seen, and yet the cost of doing business up there are too high. That's the general feedback we get when we're out on the road. This,
Commissioner, I think it's important. Part of what we're doing here while we're educating ourselves on steps forward is educating the public in Alaska. And I think an important piece of this discussion is whether or not folks believe that there are adequate supplies to increase throughput that exist on the North Slope. So expanding on your being convinced, we may like to have your geologists come forward from the state, and we will be calling lots of industry folks as well to convince us that there are adequate supplies that could result in increasing throughput. I think it's a key discussion point in on this subject.
Mr. Chairman, we'd welcome the chance to do that. We did it in front of the Senate Resources Committee last year, and I do think we have some of the top geologists in the country, and they can lay out their views in a way more articulate and knowledgeable way than I can.
Okay. Other questions at this stopping point? Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, just one quick one. Do the majors share your optimism on the resources up there and the ability to stem the decline?
Through the chair, I think the majors see both infield, the recognition of the huge unconventional potential, and then obviously in different parts of federal lands on the North Slope, I think they see very significant potential. I don't want to put words in their mouths. You know, the shale play, we put a lot of effort into trying to get people up here to lease that, to get investors, and that remains to be seen. I mean, if that, you know, North Dakota increased production from about 100,000 barrels to, I think, close to 500,000 barrels, almost all shale, in I think about 5 years. I mean, it's unbelievable that they did it. So a lot of this is not for certain, but, you know, on the shale side, and our geologists can come, we think, you know, they talk about the source rock. Well, this is obviously the source rock of Prudhoe Bay, and we think it's got huge potential, and we're hoping to attract more companies than just Great Bear, although we're really glad that Great Bear is up there working that issue hard.
Okay. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Understanding that shale development takes a lot more drilling, a lot more wells and such, is it also quicker to come online than conventional oil wells?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, it's a, we, trying to anticipate and getting in front of this potential play, you know, we set up a task force that DNR was leading with a lot of the other state agencies to kind of be ready to think through the issues. We've met with the North Dakota regulators and counterparts, and you know, that's another, we would welcome Bill Barron to come to this committee and brief you on what, how they saw these things. I don't actually know the answer to that question, but we can get that back, or we can get back on that question. I don't want to make a guess and then have it be wrong.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
So if you look at just, this is just a map, and again, I think the takeaway here is it depicts some of the wells. It shows you not only state land but federal, and you know, access to these lands is very important. And then again, it shows you kind of different places. And one thing we do, we're optimistic on the resource, but as you know, Mr. Chairman, that's going to require billions, multiple billions of dollars of investment to bring that to production and through exploration. So quickly, what I wanted to touch on next is what we saw is two other very positive developments. If you look at slide 8, I actually have the book here, right? Pretty big deal that two trends that we think can positively affect Alaska as well. First is the U.S. is going through an energy renaissance that in many ways is kind of incredible, that most people would have never predicted 10 years ago. It has a lot to do with the shale revolution, but not just that. But the International Energy Agency, which is probably the world's premier energy security think tank, you know, they do a world energy outlook. This is the 2012, and the big news here was that they are predicting the U.S. will be the largest producer of oil and the largest producer of gas by 2020, bigger than Russia, bigger than Saudi Arabia. So the implications for the country, whether it's trade deficit, jobs, national security, huge. And importantly, if you look at the down the slide a little bit, it's also indicative of what is a enormous capital spending boom by the oil industry. And a lot of that is taking place in the U.S. Now, the numbers on the slide are global numbers, but if you look at 2012, the estimates were in the industry about $600 billion spent on exploration and production. $600 billion, and the projections for 2013 are about $650 billion. So we think that the two important takeaways on this slide are, we believe the state of Alaska certainly needs to be part of the leading edge of this American energy renaissance as opposed to an anchor. And a lot of the spending is going to OECD countries. North American countries are, you know, the companies are kind of moving away from some of the more hot spots. You know, this latest trouble in Algeria, I think, gives you an example of why they would be doing that. And then we also think that it's obviously critical to get more of that global spending and to have an investment environment that can attract what, by any measure, is a global investment, exploration and production bonanza in terms of investment. And you see there, we need to get in on that more.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you. So if we're likely to be the world's largest global oil producer, I assume that some of that will be for export. And I'm wondering how Alaska's position for exporting compares to the rest of the nation. Do we have advantages for some parts of the world, or are we competing with ourselves in other parts of the country?
You know, through the chair, Senator Gardner, I you know, with regard to oil, I'm not sure we would be a major exporter, because even with the numbers that they're citing, we're not going to satisfy our domestic demand with regard to oil. Okay. But with regard to gas, I think it's pretty likely that, you know, within 10 years, we're probably going to be a significant gas LNG exporter. And we, as this committee knows, we've been working hard and certainly want it to be that Alaska's the biggest North American exporter of gas, but that's a whole nother topic.
Thank you.
So, and then what we wanted to do on slides 9 and 10 is just provide a couple examples. Commissioner Butcher has some slides later, but, you know, we think we have the geology, or we're optimistic on that. Many companies do too. There's a global investment boom that's happening that's in many ways centered in the U.S. So we think all those things are positive, even though we know we have challenges. The question is, can we turn this around? And we think that there's some pretty good recent examples. As I mentioned, slide 15 later in the packet will show several jurisdictions, Texas, North Dakota, Alberta, bending their decline curves backwards. So that's obviously examples in the U.S. Now, a lot of that is the shale technological production, but it's not all shale, and you know, we have the opportunity with regard to shale. And then we thought this is really recent. This is news items from the UK, and they went through something. I think in many ways the North Sea has a lot of similarities, characteristics with regard to the basin, as does the North Slope. And the UK had a period, I guess, a couple of years ago where they had raised taxes. There was a lot of angst, and they took a pretty significant, and we have some of the details on that, not too much, but some of the things that we're looking at possibly doing in some ways relate to this. Related, not exactly. But they undertook a significant tax reform, package of tax reform, and if you read these articles, it looks like it's having an impact that, almost seems very close to immediate. And again, I'm reading these, but you look at these in terms of, they're talking about multiple billions, creating 50,000 new jobs, a surge of investment that's expected in the North Sea, prompting record-breaking leasings. And they are saying that this is all the result primarily of the significant tax reform. And interestingly enough, in some of these articles, and we can provide the committee the articles, you know, they're talking about, look, we think even though we're cutting taxes, that with this kind of investment, we're going to, in a couple of years, actually have increased revenues because we're getting to fields that we weren't getting to previously. So it's a pretty pertinent, that article is from like 4 days, a week ago, and it's an example that looks like it's somewhat pertinent, again, because of the basin itself. And so that's one example. And as I mentioned, Commissioner Butcher has several. And then this is just on slide, slide 10. This is more of just a field example. And this is just one example. Again, it's North Sea. It's a field called the Forties. And it was taken over by Apache. But you can see that they beat the decline curve here. And I think this was principally conventional oil. But just a company like Apache that specializes in coming into mature basins and really trying to squeeze out the production. So that's just another good example. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, just two other slides here before Commissioner Butcher goes in. You know, we know this committee has a much broader mandate than just taxes. And what we have been focused on from the state's perspective is a comprehensive plan that covers a whole host of areas beyond just tax reform. We see that the tax reform is key, critical, but we also wanted this committee to know that for the last couple of years, we have been very focused on different aspects of our plan, whether it's permitting reform, whether it's encouraging what we call the next phases of North Slope development, so large, whether it's the OCS, whether it's the unconventionals, and then this idea of getting out, promoting the state, talking about the resources, actually targeting certain companies that we think would be a good fit up here. And as the governor noted in the State of the State, you know, we think that the problem in terms of attracting investment is not below ground, but above ground. And we think that as part of this strategy, enhancing global competitiveness and the investment climate. There's ways to do that, infrastructure development, that aren't necessarily related to taxes, but we think that the tax reform element, meaningful tax reform, is key to that. And so the final slide is, as I mentioned, we think that that strategy is starting to pay off. We've had some positive, two good North Slope lease sales the last 2 years, where again, we've gone out, been aggressively pitching companies, presenting. We're still gonna do that. We have the opportunity to actually speak at the big NAEP conference in Houston here in a couple weeks, got a speaking role to present Alaska. We've given to some committee members, Oil and Gas Journal did a big overview of Alaska in their December edition that goes to like 30,000 of the top CEOs in the world. So we're trying to get out there. We think that we're seeing some positive results. This slide's quite a busy one, the slide 12, but it gives you a sense of the diversity of plays, diversity of companies. So again, to Senator Gardner's question, we're trying to attract all types, all players, but certainly the incumbents in the units are very important to this equation. And but we think we're just scratching the surface here. We think this is a good beginning. We think that having, you know, everybody from the incumbents to Exxon being an operator to Shell to Brooks Range, Link, Repsol certainly, Armstrong, but Great Bear, but we could attract so much more, we believe. And so that's kind of the end of my overview portion, and I'll turn it over to Commissioner Butcher unless there's other questions on some of the slides.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I have a quick question. It's a little bit not on topic here today, but, and so if you want to give me an answer separately, but I'd like to ask it anyway. In the beginning of your presentation, you talked about the role of the U.S. Congress in approving and rapidly developing TAPs. Do you see a place for that in terms of a gas pipeline? Is there things that we should be doing today to try to get congressional, other than the loan guarantees, which you know, we've been working on? So if you have suggestions for that, I'd like to hear about.
Sure.
We'll
later.
If you have a quick one.
No, just very quick, through the chair, Senator Gardner. We can we'll get back on that. But anything that helps like that TAPS legislation to help accelerate with regard to permitting and we think that would be helpful.
And we have hundreds of great questions, but
okay.
Stay on the TAPS throughput. Yeah, thank you, though. Thank you, Commissioner. I also want to point out that Senate President Charlie Huggins has joined us back in the room. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to start out on slide 13 by pointing out kind of how we went into oil tax reform this year, and starting out by the principles that the governor reiterated. Four things. One is tax reform must be fair to Alaskans. Now, this is a complex thing to discuss because with the progressivity in ACEs, what you might see at $120 a barrel is a huge cut by government and a small cut to industry. What you see at low prices, say $20 a barrel, is a big cut of what there is anyway, by companies, and almost no take by government. And so we're looking at trying to set something up that's fair to Alaskans while still getting the investment and the development we need across a broad range of prices, not the way it currently works. Second point was to encourage new production. And it's very important that be understood, that we're not just looking at new production in new fields or challenged production such as heavy or viscous. We're talking about the legacy fields here, because if you look at the Department of Revenue's long-term forecast for production, even 10 years out, the majority of oil we see coming from the legacy fields. So this has to play, not just in the short term, as Commissioner Sullivan pointed out, in terms of getting the short-term production up, but even in the long term. That's where we know for a fact the vast majority of oil is. And we're optimistic there are more sizable fields out there, but that's what we know as of today. Point three is simple, so that it restores balance to the system. And by balance, I mentioned a little bit what I talked about between government take
and industry take being so different at high prices and at low prices. Not to overlook the first word of that principle, though, which is simple. And I know I've had many conversations with companies, and not nearly to the degree Commissioner Sullivan has, that have looked at either bought into the field with leases or looked at buying into the field and found our tax structure so complex that they've found it virtually impossible to be able to explain to their board of directors what would happen on investment in Alaska and where it would go. And a good example, there's a company that bought in that spent a month having its highest level accountants digging into how to interpret our fields, Alaska, talking to the Department of Revenue. Our folks spent a tremendous amount of time talking to them. They reached out to international consultants, and after a month, they still weren't entirely sure they could go in front of their board and explain what happens at certain prices, what happens at different level, production levels. And that is a huge problem, because right off the bat, as Commissioner Sullivan had pointed out, it's expensive to do business in Alaska. It might be the most expensive place in the world to do business. So we've got a hurdle that we have to overcome right out of the gate. If they can't explain to their folks, the decision makers, what's going to happen, we stand almost no chance of getting a lot of new investment. And we're by far the most complex tax structure in North America. In fact, we're probably the most complex tax structure in the world. We've still been looking to find if there's anybody that has anything like we do, with our progressivity and all the different credits and how difficult it is to understand it. And we've yet to find that jurisdiction.
Commissioner, can I ask you a question? It's not an easy one. We all talk about being fair to Alaskans. What does that mean to the administration?
Mr. Chairman, the place we kind of began, as we generally looked at it, was the principles that Governor Hammond had laid out when oil production first started beginning, which was the one-third, one-third, one-third. A third for the state government, a third for the federal government, and a third for the companies. But ultimately, looking at it in a view of what's fair to Alaska and what input from companies say they see as a game changer could potentially move that a little bit. But that was kind of the ballpark piece that we looked at. When you look, and we'll go through this, in upcoming meetings about what the government take is, you're going to see that it never works out to be a third, a third, a third. The state of Alaska's take is much larger than the federal government's. But from the perspective of a company, they're still viewing a dollar going to the federal government, a dollar going to the state government, as a dollar going to government. So we didn't really worry too much about the separation between the two. More, what's the government take? What's the company take?
Okay,
Mr. Chairman, if I may just add to that, I mean, there's a fairness kind of in the present tense, but there's also the issue, and I think the governor talked about it in the State of the State, this fairness to not only this generation, but beyond, right? And so if you have a system that's going like this, but we think we can turn it around, and there's no plan to change, and the status quo is driving it into, you know, very low production, we don't think that's fair to Alaskans, particularly the next generation of Alaskans, particularly if we think that we have a resource base and that can extend for many, many more years. So there's a fairness element that kind of the snapshot today, but there's a fairness aspect here to the future generations, and that's another component of how we view the fairness issue.
Thank you.
And then, Mr. Chairman, picking up on principle four, durable for the long term, which speaks to being competitive and also speaks to trying to take a look at a tax system that doesn't just work short term at the expense of long term or vice versa, but works both under short term or under long term. Because any company is going to tell you, and it's frankly common sense, that if they're looking at investing money in jurisdictions that haven't changed their tax structure in many years to decades, they have a pretty solid idea about what the future holds as they invest dollars in that state or that country. When you look at the state of Alaska and you see that, you know, this will now be the third tax change that will occur in a 6 or 7 year period, you're going to have companies taking a step back saying, we don't even understand what's going on in the state of Alaska. You continue changing it, you continue tweaking it, deciding something needs to something doesn't work, something does work. So it's our goal as we go into this to make it a long-term answer so Alaska doesn't continue to be this kind of schizophrenic state that continues to update and change their tax structure every few years. As we went into it, we went in putting together an integrated team with the Department of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources on a much larger scale than we have before. We also brought on new consultants, Econ One, which some of you may know have done work for both the administration and for the legislature over the years on both oil and gas. So some of you will recognize Barry Pulliam when he comes up to testify. And so that's the base of how we moved forward on our oil tax reform legislation. Moving to slide 14, as you look at the process that we went through in developing the bill, the team reviewed previous work that the administration had done, that the legislature had done. We looked at previous bills over the last number of years, and we worked to identify problems with the current tax system. Obviously, and we'll get to a slide here in a few, we're seeing declining production that goes above and beyond what any other oil producing jurisdiction in North America is seeing. That's a problem. Competitive environment, we went into it saying, are we competitive? What do we need to look at? What do we need to do to become more competitive? Who do we need to compare ourselves to? And that's something that we gave many presentations on the last 2 years. The legislature also had many presentations on it, but it's a continually evolving process of trying to best determine who our competitors are to figure out what we need to do to become more competitive.
Commissioner, I think that's a key concept, and it's one that we've kicked around through the years. I mean, even PFC put us very high in the level of average government take, even comparing us to countries that we don't call our friends. We're up there. So whose role is it to determine where we want to be in that overall place for average government take for oil and gas production taxes and severance taxes? Is it the legislature's role? Is it the administration's role? I think we have to pick a number before we understand where we want to be.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is a good question. We will lay out where we see us in terms of competitiveness and where we believe we should be. You have consultants that will certainly weigh in on that as well. But ultimately, it comes down to the policymakers. It comes down to the legislature, and it comes down to the governor to determine what will make us competitive and what makes the most sense in moving forward on our taxes.
Quick follow-up. Is there a place in the average government take globally where we can see excitement beginning to occur versus a level where there's not much happening because the take is too high? Is there a correlation that you're aware of?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not. When our consultant Barry Pulliam is up here, he might have an answer to that question. I don't have a specific answer to it.
And we'll also be employing commissioning PFC to do some work for independent work for this committee, and that may be a very good question to ask them. But you know, where should we be in that level of government take, and what leads to excitement for new players and people that could increase our flow through taps? So, okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We looked at progressivity, what's working, what's not working. Progressivity is a concept that isn't completely without precedent in other places. There are a few places that have it, but by and large, it's not the norm. And the few places that do have progressivity deal with it more on a bracketed level. Whereas the price of oil goes up, those pieces of it are taxed higher, and they don't come in and sweep the entire barrel of oil like we do. So that's also something we'll get into, and we'll show you kind of how progressivity works in relation to other jurisdictions as well as in relation to Alaska if we didn't have progressivity. And finally, and this is a very key piece of it too, tax credits. Here in a few slides, I'll go over what we have paid out, what liabilities have been in tax credits over the last few years, and we dug into what's working, what isn't working, what can be changed to work better. Because as every year goes by, that issue becomes larger and larger, and that's something we dug into before we introduced the bill. And the two departments also coordinated our efforts to understand the impact of production decline on TAPs. As Commissioner Sullivan had pointed out, there are issues with the reduction in flow in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and it's more than the question of what decade is it going to shut down. It's going to have very real effects very soon, and I'll be touching on that here in a few slides as well. Taking a look at slide 15, how did our competition fare when prices spiked? And what we tried to do is lay out a graph, and I know it's a little busy, I apologize, that laid out the states and provinces that are the biggest oil producers in North America, as well as Alaska, over the last number of decades to see what the price of oil has been and what's happened in those different states. And so the green dotted line has been the price of oil, and you can see it bounced along low $10, $20, $30 for decades. And then just recently, in the last 5, 6, 7 years, it's shot up. As a result, I'd like to point out a few things. The red line, Alberta, has just kind of bounced along and shot up, and the high price of oil has a huge role in that. The oil sands, that it's a tremendous resource in Alberta, did not pencil at low oil prices. Once the oil prices went up to the levels we've been seeing, it pencils, it's making a lot of money for Alberta and the companies up there. Also down at the bottom, you can see North Dakota. Very much the same thing. They bounced along, they were producing oil on a yearly basis, it wasn't a tremendous amount, and we all know about the oil shale going on in North Dakota. But the interesting thing about it is everybody likes to attribute it to a technological advance, which was a major piece of it. But you can't ignore the fact that the price of oil had to be, we traveled to the state of North Dakota and talked to their officials down there 2 years ago, had to be above $70 a barrel. They said for it to pencil in North Dakota, they needed at least $70 oil, if not higher. So if we were looking at $40 or $50 oil today, like we were not too many years ago, we wouldn't be talking about North Dakota. They would just be, you know, pumping out 80,000, 60,000, whatever their level was. And so it's been a combination of the technological advance and the high price of oil that's made it economic. But what I think is the biggest takeaway from this graph is what you see when you look at the Texas decline, which is the yellow line, and the Alaska slope, which was the blue, and you can see it shooting up, and Texas on their decline, and matching up about 1990, when Alaska peaked, and when Texas continued the decline. And for a couple of decades, it's amazing how close the oil decline in the state of Texas and the oil decline in the state of Alaska ran. You see it continuing until the price of oil spiked. At that point, state of Texas flattens out, starts to turn around, and now begins to shoot up. State of Alaska continues on what would have been Texas's decline as well over those periods of time. So we're not seeing the production increase with those high oil prices that Texas is. And when we first looked at it, the first thought was, okay, they're more advanced, they've gone farther down the road with shale oil than we have. But the fact is, the flattening out was 100% conventional oil. The beginning to turn around and bump up the increase was also all conventional oil. It wasn't until the shale kicked in, and you can see the huge spike, that the unconventional factored in. So this was a state that was on the same decline curve we were, that was able to flatten out and begin to turn it around all on conventional oil. Because the fact of the matter was, when they're looking at $80, $90, $100 oil, there are a lot of things that didn't previously. There were a lot of wells that had been shut in, a lot of developments that they were able to go back into because it made more economic sense and made the money at $90, $100 a barrel than it would have when they were shut in at $20 or $30 a barrel. So this speaks to what Commissioner Sullivan had pointed out, which is the question that we've always had, which is decline inevitable? Is this just something we have to ride down? We actually have proof that it's not. And we're seeing these from states that don't have nearly the resources the state of Alaska does. Texas or North Dakota, I mean, we have shale plays in Alaska that dwarf North Dakota. Will we be able to produce them? That's a question. But so, you know, it's not a matter of having to continue to decline while the more resource-rich states turn it around, because we are the most resource-rich state.
It's almost as if we initially asked the question, hey, can you do this? Is anyone turning it around? Has anyone turned it around? And we're starting to see that everybody's turning it around but us. I mean, this graph says a lot, especially as Commissioner Butcher says that Texas, Alaska,
match up for decades, and then they're going in the right direction.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. During the decades where Alaska and Texas production decline matched up so closely, what do we know about their government tax take compared to ours?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, their tax rate has been was low during that period of time. Texas is among the lowest, and that hasn't changed. I can't speak specifically to what the royalty that they may have paid primarily private landowners for the development on it. I would speculate that it's not probably a whole lot above where we are, but I don't know that for a fact. We'd have to get back to you on that.
Thank you.
I just have a question. It's sort of theoretical, but theoretically, we would have two product lines where some states would only have one. If we could develop our shale gas play, you would have something that produces well at a high price environment, yet on a low price environment, we would still have conventional that sort of backs us up. That would be more challenging in a place like North Dakota. Is that correct?
You mean the shale oil play, or did you say the shale gas
play? Shale oil play. Yes. If I said gas, I apologize, but I meant shale oil play. I mean, North Dakota essentially has one product line. It's exactly. Shale production. So when we talk about possibly thinking about decoupling different types of oil, we could be encouraging additional production at lower prices if shale does play out in the future.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that is what we could do, and in fact, that's a piece of what we've looked at, is trying to target things that are more challenged and try to determine what we would have to do to make it economic. Because a good example, to not go specifically to that, because I don't think we have enough information yet, on shale would be heavy oil, which BP just announced they weren't going to be pursuing, at least in the near term, heavy oil. The question then becomes, what needs to occur to incentivize that production, and determining what it is we need to do, and then deciding as a state if that's what we would want to do today to move that forward.
Okay, thank you.
Taking a look at slide 16, and this is a snapshot of what you'll be seeing from our consultants, Econ One. So I'll touch on it, won't go into too much detail, because you'll get a much more in-depth explanation from Barry Pulliam. But it gives you an idea about what we've done with our consultants, where we've compared Alaska to other opportunities using detailed models and analyzing a variety of metrics. The examples of 50 million barrel development in Alaska and the comparable development in the lower 48, unconventional, Canada and the UK, well, we won't see Canada here, but you'll see it in some of the presentations. The UK post 93 with their brownfield, which is in their incentives that they've currently put in place, as well as a comparison to Norway. And as Commissioner Sullivan had mentioned, PFC Energy last year, in comparing us to OECD countries and states and provinces, listed us as number two, only to Norway in the world of OECD. And at $140 a barrel, we shoot past Norway to number one. So that's kind of a little bit of a barometer of the most extreme example out there. So obviously, as you look at it, what it's showing you is at an example of different prices. The dollar amount you see is what a company would make per barrel under ACES currently, under Lower 48 unconventional, Norway, and then the UK post 93 with brownfield. And it gives you an idea what a company would see in their investment at these different prices. The closer we get to Norway, the more extreme we're getting in terms of the government take. And as you can see, you look at 100, 110 where we've been most recently, their bang for their buck is almost at $110, almost half of what they'd be getting per barrel in the lower 48, and much less than that even again with UK. And so we'll be able to give you a breakdown. We looked at it a lot of different views. We looked at it from an internal rate of return, net present value. We've looked at company cash flows, profitability, and we'll be able to break down just about any angle you're interested in looking at, as well as being able to compare to different areas, because you do need to see where do we stack up, and what would a company be looking at if a company looked at Alaska and a company looked at putting their money elsewhere, because that's ultimately what they're looking at.
Commissioner, quick question for you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I've seen very different numbers published about that looks like page 16. Why the difference? Why do we see some publications that have Alaska with a higher profit per barrel, sometimes exaggerated beyond belief? How do we know which is the right number, and how do we base our decisions?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very, very complicated issue. And as you not only have to look at how progressivity works and be able to determine that when looking at different prices, but you also have to look at how the credits factor in. And that's where Department of Natural Resources, Department of Revenue, working with Econ One, we're able to give them absolutely the most up-to-date information we have. So we can't speak specifically as to who produces what outside of our two departments, but we can tell you that specifically what is presented will be how our tax system works.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to find some way to bring the groups together so that we're giving Alaskans the real numbers, whatever they may be. And if that's the time and you put into this study and they're the real numbers, then we need to make that clear.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, generally our numbers folks and our consultant, your consultant's numbers folks, all get together to make sure that the inputs to go into models produce the same numbers, because we could spend an entire session bickering about what numbers and what outputs. And so we worked very hard on that. We were able to do that last year. I think we'll be able to do that again this year.
Thank you.
I'm taking a look at slide 17, and I'll just touch on this. It deals with the difficulty of defining progressivity. And you look at progressivity, which is you pay a rate of 25%. You have to figure out what your production tax value is, taking the price of oil, subtracting transportation costs, subtracting lease expenditures. You have to determine what lease expenditures qualify, what don't qualify. That then gets you to your production tax value. That's taxed at 25% until it gets to $30 a barrel, and then it's taxed at 0.4% or 0.4% for every dollar that it increases, up to $92.50 of production tax value. Then it goes up 0.1% per dollar until it gets to 75%. And that just gives you a general idea of how complex it is. You look at Texas, which is at 6%, or I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's a set number. You look at North Dakota, they have kind of progressivity where they split it in half, and up to $50 a barrel is at 8%, and then over is at 11.5%. And to give you an idea about how much complex our system is in North Dakota, when we visited them, the commissioner in North Dakota said they have one guy in their department that does oil taxes. One person, and I threatened to overpay him and draw him to the state of Alaska, which he didn't find as humorous as I did. But, you know, we have an entire department full of folks working on it, and I'll be honest, we still, you'll see in our budget, we still could use more people to try to go through and factor, making sure the lease expenditures are what they should be, making sure that everything, that the tax credits are accurate and everything. So it's really a difficult tax to understand, and it's difficult from the state of Alaska's perspective on administering. Very difficult.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Yeah, it seems to me, just reading the description here, that the difficult thing is calculating production tax value, what can be included, what can't. But in terms of the changing of progressivity and adding a different values, that's just a formula you put into a spreadsheet. And you plug in your production, you plug in the sales price, you plug in the allowable expenses, and the whole thing just shifts all that. I mean, it's complicated to explain and maybe to set up your spreadsheet, but once you've got that going, it seems like that's not the hard part.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, what companies have told us are so difficult is they have to run an almost endless number of different when they look at different prices of oil. They can't just decide, okay, we believe it's going to be $115 a barrel for the next 10 years. What does that do for our company? They have to understand what 110 means, what 100 means, what 80 means, what 40 means, what 150 means. And that's the huge difference between progressivity and some of the other regimes we've looked at, where it's, they understand very simply, it's 7%. It's 7% of $150, it's 7% of $30. And so it's trying to factor in not just what is going to happen in the future, but how it's going to affect their company at those different levels that they've told us is most difficult.
You know, I think that'd be the least of their calculations, actually. Lots and lots of calculations and very smart people working on them. And progressivity's not, I don't accept that as being too challenging for them.
Well, Senator, we'll have some of the companies here, and you can ask them that directly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I could add just one thing, Senator Gardner, the monthly aspect of our tax also makes it difficult, where it has to be factored on a monthly basis, and the progressivity that factors into that month, as opposed to other places that do it annually, where it's just simply a very simple annual equation. Taking a look at slide 18, this gives you a little bit of a snapshot of what the state has been paying out and taking off companies' liability in terms of tax credits. You can see we have the pre-2009 numbers and then the numbers that have been bouncing up and down a little bit, but over the current year and the fiscal year 14, we see moving up. In 2013, we see about $800 million in tax credits, which is a combination of $360 million that are paid out to companies that don't have a tax liability as cash by the state of Alaska, and the rest being the producing companies that take it off of their liability they have to the state. So that's about $800 million to the state this year. In FY14, we see it as being about $1 billion. And so this is something that, as we looked at it, we determined, okay, what are we getting for $1 billion? Are we getting increase in production? Are we getting, what are we getting other than increased spending? And that's where we were having difficulty being able to quantify that. We can see that the tax credit system is incentivizing spending, but we haven't been able to connect that with increases in production. And as a result of that, we've gone into this bill very cautiously, because just to give you a hypothetical, if the price of oil were to drop to $80, $90 a barrel over the course of a year, which is historically still one of the highest years in history, we'd be looking at a deficit in the billions of dollars. The governor, you as the legislature, would be looking at places to cut. You'd be looking to all of the areas that are being funded for a reason, that are to a benefit of the people of the state of Alaska, and you'd have this $1 billion sitting there that the state would still be paying out or not be getting any revenue because of the liability aspect of it. So as long as we're flush with revenues, the $800 million or the $1 billion we're looking at every year doesn't have nearly the effect it would have in decision-making and policy-making if we do look at a deficit. And if there's one thing we know about the price of oil, it always goes up and it always goes down. It's not going to stay at $109 a barrel or above forever. Also, thinking about it in terms of what we've been looking for, what we would want in the kind of investment that Commissioner Sullivan and DNR has been looking for, he talked about $50 billion going to the North Sea. Imagine if the state of Alaska got $20 billion. We got $20 billion of investment over a 3 or 4 year period. We're looking at $8 billion to $10, $12 billion in what the state would be on the hook for in the tax credits. So you really have to stop and think, what are we getting for what we're paying out? And that is where we spent a lot of time focusing on and analyzing, because it's one of those things, be careful what you wish for. We want so badly to have companies come in and invest. We want to get more companies here. But on the front end of the state of Alaska, you have to, especially as somebody in charge of the state treasury, you have to take a step back and say, okay, it's all great that they're here, but there is an effect to us on the front end, and is this the way we want to move forward, and if so, how do we manage this?
Commissioner, can I clarify something just from my understanding?
Sure.
It looks to me like that from pre-2009 through 2014, we've averaged paying out an average of probably around $375 million for credit certificates that did not produce a drop of oil?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yeah, a breakdown of exactly what we're seeing. I mean, there are explanations a company could give that are currently doing business up there about what may have been produced that wouldn't have been produced as a result of these. We haven't, and certainly this forum will allow the opportunity to have those conversations, but we were never able in our five-year look back to make those direct connections. Also, Mr. Chairman, if you total them up, it would total a little under $6 billion, $5.85 billion that the state has either taken off the tax liabilities of companies or paid out in cash in the last 5, 6 years, 7 years.
And what would, on a year like 2011, what would be the conditions that would make the refunds higher than the credits applied against production?
Mr. Chairman, it's strictly whatever companies pay, we reimburse. And so if you see a higher number in the gray, meaning those are companies that are new in Alaska and don't have a tax liability, aren't producing oil in Alaska, it's just a matter of that year, there were more companies, spent more money. And we are simply just kind of a factory that sends the cash out when those companies qualify for it. And we certainly check to make sure the work is done, the spending is done, and that they qualify, but it's not a matter of having a certain cap saying that we're going to pay up to $300 million or $400 million. It completely relies on whatever companies spend in a given year.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just want to make sure that I captured this correctly. So on the tax credits, the production tax credits, what you're saying is there's no evidence that you have at this time that indicates that those tax credits have increased production?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, we do not have that information. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, we just haven't seen it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just if I can, on this point, I think when you look at the governor's principles, when he talks about simple, that Commissioner Butcher was talking about, but also that restores balance to the system. And that's one of the things that we think's pretty important, particularly if, as Commissioner Butcher mentioned, if you actually do get, that's one slide here that we have where a lot of activity, a lot of investment, kind of the, and we need to make sure that it's a system that's balanced, that at the end of the day, if we're getting all the investment and production that we are trying to get, that it also leaves our treasury in a good spot. And mm-hmm. if you start to get to lower prices, as Commissioner Butcher mentioned, the credits don't fluctuate with price. So if you have lower prices, you're still you still have a credit bill that is whatever the spend level is.
Senator? Again, just for clarification, so the tax credits are really spending credits and not tied to production. In other words, they don't come to you with evidence that there was more production, you pay the tax credit for that production. It was spending.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that is correct. They need to qualify under law, show that it's a capital expenditure or whatever the specific tax credit was, but that's the only requirement, that they, under law, the spending qualifies, and then they get the tax credit.
Thank you.
Jumping to slide 19, and I know we're running short of time, so I don't have to go into great detail on this. This slide, Mr. Chairman, mostly brings up the point you made that regardless if we talk about the length of the taps working or not, we do know that as the flow drops, the operating costs are more, the capital costs are more. It's taking days longer to get down the pipeline. When the oil gets there, it's not at the temperature is now lower. Ice and all of the other issues that certainly Admiral Barrett would be able to go into far more detail than I would. What I would like to point out about this slide, however, is DNR and DOR have worked together this year on the modeling to make it far more dynamic than it used to be before, in terms of not just taking a look at things and saying, okay, next year we're looking at this tariff, this is what it means, actually being able to move it back and forth to determine what spending would mean to the tariff and what it would mean to the state treasury. And so the second point under preliminary observations, you'll see that price, production, and tariff provided in the Department of Revenue's fall 2012 revenue sources book, a $1 increase in tariff through TAPS will decrease state oil and gas revenue by an average of $110 million. So as we look at it being more expensive to, for the pipeline to be run, and we're looking at higher tariffs, it's having a very substantial effect on state revenues.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. The second paragraph on the left side, I'm not sure I understand it. Current work not designed to find the optimal low flow mitigation option or forecast. Current work, whose current work?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, what it was saying is what's been done currently, what it's saying is the work we're doing now, we haven't designed to try to come up with what the optimal low flow mitigation option, or we're not going through models to try to determine when TAPS is going to run out or when it's going to shut down. It's specifically running models to determine what the effect of increased tariff or lower tariff will have on the state treasury.
Thank you. Can we not assume that the operators and the owners are doing that kind of work? It's just that's not our job. That our job is what you're doing, which is evaluating the impact on state revenues.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Gardner, you're right. They are doing that work.
Okay.
We just wanted
somebody
to make the point.
Somebody
should be. Yeah, that if somebody asked us a question and said, okay, based on your model, how many years are we going to go? How low can we go? We're not getting involved in any of those issues.
Right. And just Admiral Barrett will be covering those issues when he's...
Right. I just didn't understand the paragraph, what it referred to.
And finally, wrapping up on slide 20, we get to what our tax reform proposal will be. The highlights, and we're going to have Mike Pawlowski come up to touch on a sectional analysis that tells you exactly what the bill does. But very broadly, it eliminates progressivity, and it eliminates credits based on capital expenditures, which are the 20% capital expenditure credit on the North Slope. It reforms the remaining credits to be carried forward to when there's production. So if you earn a tax credit, you can take the tax credit off of your taxes when you have a tax liability. The state would no longer be paying cash out on a yearly basis. It establishes a gross revenue exclusion, a GRE, for newer units and new participating areas and existing units, targeting new oil. And this is a concept that can be used to target many of the more challenged areas, whether it's a new area that's far from infrastructure and the cost is more than it would be in the legacy field, or heavier viscous or anything, it can be shaped to try to change the system to focus specifically on trying to get that more challenged oil developed and produced. And the bill makes no change to Cook Inlet and Middle Earth. This applies very specifically and strictly to the North Slope. And with that, Mr. Chairman, Mike Pawlowski from the Department of Revenue would like to come up and give a sectional analysis of the bill, which I think will be rather brief.
Thank you. I'd like to thank both of you for taking the time to be before us today, and we will, I'm sure, have additional questions as we move through this process.
We look forward to it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Gentlemen, if you can please identify yourselves. Are you coming up one at a time? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michael Pawlowski, and I'm the advisor to the Commissioner of Revenue for Petroleum Fiscal Systems, and
I'm Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Natural Resources.
And Mr. Chairman, I understand that the conscious of the clock, but what we wanted to do was, at least in the introduction of the proposal, we understand it is a complex bill that Alaskans and legislators and their staff are trying to approach. And so what the department did was put together a presentation that, since we can't get it on the screen, I'll walk through with page numbers for you. And it's the one that says overview of SB 21 oil and gas production tax. And what we've tried to do in this presentation, Mr. Chairman, is walk through the four elements of the proposal, the governor's proposal that the Commissioner of Revenue just mentioned, and highlight which sections of the bill relate to each one of those proposals. So in the future, we can do a detailed sectional walkthrough with the committee, but so that people are aware of which proposals fall into which bucket and what part of the bill. We thought this would be useful for the committee to get started in looking at. So to restate what the commissioner just said, the proposal generally is to eliminate progressivity and credits based on capital expenditures. Second, to reform the remaining credits to be carried forward to when there is production. Third, to establish the gross revenue exclusion for those newer units and new participating areas in existing units. And fourth, to make preserve the current tax ceilings and treatments in south of the north 68 degrees latitude, which has been referred to as Middle Earth or Cook Inlet. So going to page 3, we see on this page the elimination of progressivity and the credits based on capital expenditures. The primary sections of the bill that relate to the elimination of progressivity are sections 1 and sections 26. In conforming to those changes, the bill also has sections 2, 5, 6, and 22 are all related back to those, the decision to eliminate progressivity. The North Slope qualified capital expenditure credits are primarily section 8 of the bill in relationship to that, but again, you have conforming sections in 7, 11, and 12. And Mr. Chairman, as I said, these are really intended to do guideposts, and we have a very detailed walk through each provision for when the committee would prefer to do that. And I can,
Mr. Senator Dunley.
Chair, just a brief point of clarification on progressivity. You said 1 and 26?
Yes.
So it's 2 is actually in the conforming sections?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, that's correct. Okay. 2 is a conforming change because of the change made in section 1 and 26.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Can you speak to the rationale for having whole harmless provisions for Middle Earth and Cook Inlet and not doing that for other, say, smaller developers or explorers on the North Slope?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, getting into the conversation of the holding harmless in Cook Inlet, what you see primarily there is the treatment of the tax ceilings. The legislature itself has put in provisions that limit the taxes in the areas south of 68 degrees. So Middle Earth has a 4% okay. tax based on the work the legislature did last year.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, going back to the North Slope qualified capital expenditure credits, that sections 8 is the main section, but then 7, 11, and 12 are the conforming. Page 4 is the North Slope net operating loss credits. When we talk about reforming the credits to be carried forward against production, this is the credit that is being reformed where it used to be available where a company on the North Slope could bring it to the state to receive a cash payment for it. The credit still exists, but in the treatment of the bill, it's required to be carried forward until there's a production tax liability and then used to offset that. The main sections in the bill dealing with that credit provision are sections 9 and sections 15. But then there are conforming changes that have to be made, and those are in sections 10, 19, and 20 as people are going through the bill. Then, Mr. Chairman, the small producer tax credit is another credit that is non-transferable and only can be taken against a production tax liability. So it's very similar to the change made to the North Slope net operating loss credit that I previously spoke to. You can find the extension of that credit in section 16 of the bill. Finally, of the main provisions, you see the gross revenue exclusion. The main change for that is in section 24 of the bill, and the conforming section is section 5. And Mr. Chairman, just walking back through those primary changes, I think what you get a feeling for is that of the basic proposals for the North Slope system, it is a relatively few sections of the bill that directly relate to those provisions. What we're seeing really in the main sections is 1 and 26, 8, 9 and 15, 16, and 24, with a few conforming sections related to that. In the next section, you see the main sections of 3 and 22 for the protection and preservation of some of those tax ceilings in Cook Inlet and Middle Earth, and then the wealth of conforming sections, because when you adjust a section, all the referencing sections have to be addressed as well. So what you see here is, as we get together and continue to work on this bill, the department just quickly wanted to give you a guidepost so that you and your staff could get a feeling for, when they're looking at a particular proposal, where in the bill to look and dig towards that proposal.
Questions?
Thank you. That's very helpful.
So we're coming to the close of the hour. We will have you back on Thursday with Econ 1 for the entire hour and a half. Would you recommend that we extend that meeting time for 30 minutes? It's a detailed discussion. We have a great panel that'll have many questions.
Mr. Chairman, I think we are available at the committee's pleasure, and okay. We work with our consultants to certainly accommodate whatever you wish.
I appreciate that. This helping us today will give us some good reading material for the next 2 days, and if we can extend the meeting on Thursday until 6 p.m., and I don't think anyone comes and arrests you for running a few minutes over anyway, but if there are no other questions, let's see, I want to make sure I don't forget something, my second meeting here. So the next meeting will be at 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, January 24th. Were there any other questions from the committee before we close out? Nope. And we'll continue our discussion on Senate Bill 21 with a presentation by Barry Pulliam with Econ 1 Research and the gentleman here before us today. And this meeting is adjourned at 17:03. Thank you.